Welcome to the A-News Podcast. This is episode 91 for November 23rd, 2018. This podcast covers anarchist activity, ideas, and conversations from the previous week on Anarchist News. It's designed to be useful to anarchists and the anarcho-curious. Give us feedback and constructive criticism at our email address, podcast@anarchistnews.org. For more information and usually some good commentary, go to the non-sectarian anarchistnews.org.
Editorial, a general review of some things, or one of the thousand plus reasons I'm an anarchist. The midterm elections have passed. Did you riot? The meetups of friends and family sharing food together are also passing. And the snowy cold has blanketed much of the land here. Winter is here a month early, and on the road outside, the car is warm with the toasty heater pumping hot air into the vehicle as many make the annual crusade to the temples of consumerism. Walking through the maze of aisles and fellow spenders, you bring up your smartphone to help you check out a bit faster among the throngs. Someone takes a selfie, and now you're on the evening news as you walk out of the store with some crap that will be thrown away next year. Welcome to the spectacle, or rewind to taking a walk through the city woods. If two words couldn't be further apart from each other, yet so refreshing. Today is Black Friday, a new cultural holiday that celebrates deals on all things consumers find they need for happiness. As a relative non-participant in such things as bargain hunting, waiting in shopping mall lines for hours, clicking through the online inventory of such places, or watching the resulting depressingly sad YouTube videos of people fighting over the last 4K 60-inch television, why would you want to watch that? I'm often left feeling like I'm not sure if I have anything to say. Astounded. Although, nothing to say. Kind of feels good sometimes. Like the Jack Kerouac zen of nothingness, or putting that dialogue on the back burner while some more significant ideas percolate. It's been years since I've read an Adbusters, but in many circles, this is still Buy Nothing Day. Or for that matter, every day is Buy Nothing Day for anarchists, unless, of course, you are of the hot topic variety. Outside of the anarchist space, marketers and researchers of cool have turned tomorrow Small Business Saturday and Monday as Cyber Monday. That's like 3 days of voting with your wallet. Did I mention the A-News Patreon? I'm kidding. There is no Patreon. The biggest joke, however, is again on the consumers, who probably won't see Black Friday deals like this ever again, with government trade tariffs ramping up. Trump jokes about the cold weather in regards to global warming and many other things on Twitter, and I don't even follow them. This is just from friends, face to face, their social media, and reported on in the media. California's still burning, with the campfire 95% contained as of today, Friday, with the rain helping to dampen and smolder the remaining wildfires. 84 confirmed dead and over 800 plus still missing. 13,000 homes destroyed and countless other objects of civilization gone. Photos and videos shared on the news and social media depicted apocalyptic scenes similar to ones you may see in the movies, or possible anarchist communiques about burned-out cars on A-News. Scoreboard check shows the anarchists really getting trounced in the attack game versus the wildfire. And on the other end, anarchist mutual aid responses? As not one from or living in California, I haven't heard much, but I'm sure it's there. I'm reminded of Superstorm Sandy, Hurricane Katrina, and other events that have triggered an anarchist disaster response. Further south in California, the caravan has reached the border in Tijuana, with some smaller groups forking off as reported by the mainstream media. Thousands of miles away, I wish them luck and await the anarchist report backs of the border struggle. There are so many things to be angry about in this world. These are only but a few. The news on a much larger scale, outside of the quiet neighborhood, on a walk through the woods.
Don't tell me how to do my job. You carry on like a son of a bitch.
What's new this week? Conference for Anarchist Mental Health Workers in New York, February 2019, from Anonymous. This is a call out to, quote, anarchist and other similarly leftist, anti-capitalist, anti-authoritarian mental health workers and students, unquote, to come to a, quote, free one-day conference to resource and skill share, build community, and strategize for how to better incorporate anarchist values into our work. We invite you to, one, share the ways you combat the capitalism, authoritarianism, patriarchy, white supremacy, etc., that impacts your clients and infects your organizations, and two, strategize for the radical rehumanization, healing, and empowerment we and our clients need. Topics to be addressed include radical case conferencing, non-hierarchical peer supervision, anti-capitalist private practice, yes, it's possible, navigating and surviving authoritarian systems and institutions, creating horizontal alternatives, and whatever else you want to share in your own breakout session related to these themes, unquote. The question of how to, and significantly whether to, blend our jobs slash vocations with anarchist principles is still open, people. Let's not pretend it's always a good thing, shall we?
Yogyakarta, solidarity with all anarchists in Russia, long live anarchy, love, Mikhail. From Anarchist BC, our lens into the mix in Yogyakarta. This is a very brief statement in support of Mikhail of self-detonation fame and all anarchists and anti-fascists in Russia. I think they mean love to Mikhail, rather than Mikhail posthumously signing the solidarity statement. Translation is hard.
Festival Father Frost Against Putin 2019 to take place in January. The first sign on ANews of an actual response against Putin and Russian repression, although it being on ANews is probably a bad sign, actually. Quote, next year, 2019, the Father Frost Against Putin Festival will once again take place in Helsinki. From the 5th to the 6th of January, you can join discussions about the state of affairs in Russia and the extra-USSR region, and get a chance to meet various social and political activists without the fear of police or special service operations. Fear of infringement from the side of police and special services. Unquote. Not sure how they think there will not be police there or police infringement, but maybe they know things I don't know. I certainly hope they do. There is sign-up information in the announcement for those of you who can go to these places. A quick wiki reveals that Father Frost is a Santa Claus-type figure, for those who care.
Argentina arrests 12 so-called anarchists in bomb attacks ahead of G20. From DW.com, quote, Argentina will be hosting the first G20 summit of world leaders ever held in South America on November 30th and December 1st, has arrested 12 people accused of being anarchists. Officials say the arrests were made in connection to two bomb incidents in the capital, Buenos Aires. Officials say that one woman, suspected of involvement in the first incident, was injured on Wednesday when a bomb went off at the mausoleum of an Argentine police chief killed by anarchists 100 years ago. The second incident involved a bag of explosive thrown at the house of a judge. The device did not go off and was later detonated by authorities, unquote. DW is a German news site. The thread has some other links to this story and related information, especially for folks who read Spanish.
Indonesia. Aftonami Press needs support for version of the Society of the Spectacle. From Anarchist BC, who gets called out in a comment for asking for support before Aftonami Press is ready, I guess? At any rate, an Indonesian press is translating Society of the Spectacle, and at some point, getting some money for that would be helpful to get it published. Maybe now, or maybe later.
Russia. Call for solidarity, anarchists, bombers, and special services against anarchists. From narobarona.info. Continuing fallout from Mikhail's bomb attack, including the cops arresting a teenager and basically making stuff up in order to punish people for this bombing, and resistance in general. Quote, 14-year-old Michael's supposed comrade was arrested by special services in Moscow on the 2nd of November. Special services accuses Kirill Kuzminkin in preparing a bomb attack on the neo-Nazi march. Kirill denies the accusation. Cops claim that components for the production of explosives have been found in Kirill's house. Kirill's father claims that these are components for the production of firecrackers, and special services are trying to present the teenager as a terrorist. Soon after the arrest of Kuzminkin, FSB announced that they are planning to arrest 10 more anarchists from Moscow, whose identities are not yet unknown. FSB says that together with Kuzminkin, these activists were part of a brigade of anarchist bombers. However, there have been no attacks involving bombs in Moscow in a long time, and teenagers such as Kuzminkin could not have participated in older attacks that happened about 7 years ago. However, the absence of such attacks does not stop the SFB from searching for anarchist bombers, unquote. The bias of the website that is the source for this story is unclear. Since it's in Russian, this story doesn't seem like the work of our enemies. Again, there is a request for solidarity with an email address, but nothing else.
Small is ugly. The uncomfortable, anti-authoritarian micropolitics of egalitarian foragers from freedomnews.uk. This title is biting and funny enough that it's hard to believe it came from Freedom News, which is not known for either biting or funny, and certainly not biting and funny. The story is about how some people in the Occupy ICE activist camp outside of Portland named themselves security and then started bossing people around, as reported by members of the camp. Quote, the Occupy ICE camp in Portland was on the brink of collapse long before it was formally cleared out this summer. The precariousness was precipitated largely by the local police, not the official state police, but a group of activists masquerading as anarchists and radicals who appointed themselves as the ICE commune's security team within days of its establishment. Multiple participants from the commune have now spoken out anonymously, describing how this authoritarian, self-appointed internal security team came to dictate the actions of the camp by deciding unilaterally that only passive resistance constituted legitimate political action, and embarrassing, shaming, attacking, and expelling from the camp those who didn't keep the line. To suppress initial criticisms, the security team rebranded themselves the Care Team. Their self-styled uniform consisted of pink bandanas, unquote. An old story. In Oakland, they're called Peace Police and included folks like Chris Crass. Of course, there are also control freaks on the more militant than thou side of the continuum. Really, control freaks are everywhere. Just saying. This report is interspersed with more mainstream anthropology as well, which makes for quite the juxtaposition. Quote, first, although intuition may suggest the opposite, environments with an anti-authoritarian ethos can be rather appealing for individuals prone to dominate. Second, there is a tendency within the left to structuralize problems, to assume that domination and oppression can always be explained in terms of capitalism, patriarchy, or racism, or some other force that transcends the individual. This is perhaps in part an ideological protest against the rampant individualization found on the right, unquote. All in all, thumbs up on this article, even if it does quote Bookchin. This article also had one of the busiest threads on ANews this week.
Update on the Brilliant Podcast. Someone posts a self-pleased summary of recent output of the podcast, including one with Seaweed, author of Land and Freedom, and the completion of the nationalist anarchist-related episodes. Also, a conversation with noted vegan Rhea is planned for the future. And if people have questions, they can suggest them on ANews.
Argentina, against the stigmatization and persecution of those who struggle, from Black Rose Federation. This is a translation of a statement against the repression in Argentina that is nominally a response to a protest at a tomb. It is not a statement for anarchy, just a statement against repression. Quote, the different human rights organizations, social and political, sign in a spirit of solidarity and coming from diverse spaces and groups that today are being pointed out and persecuted by this government, which protects the interests of the few. These groups demand the freedom of the detained comrades and the cessation of criminalization and persecution. Unquote.
Small band of fascists attempting to disrupt Boston Anarchist Book Fair are quickly repelled. From the Black Rose Federation. Folks apparently from Patriot Front, etc., came masked up and chanting bullshit slogans. Quote, within minutes of the group entering, attendees and organizers quickly surrounded the fascists and began engaging them and chanting Nazis out, Nazis out, never making it more than 10 feet past the entrance and not entering the actual book fair space itself. The entire confrontation lasted less than 10 minutes as the group quickly backed down and made an exit. No physical altercations were known to have occurred. Unquote.
Fascism, Ecology, and the Tangled Roots of Anti-Modernism, from It's Going Down by Edelweiss Pirates. This is a 5-year-old essay by someone who can't reason himself out of a paper bag about the fascist creep. Can you spell demagoguery? One of the people who gave Olympia a bad name writes another essay that drops a lot of names and thumbnail descriptions in lieu of making an argument that holds together.
The 2018 G20 in Buenos Aires, setting the stage, from CrimeThink. If you're curious about what is going on in Argentina, perhaps primed by the shorter articles earlier in the week, then this is the place to go for the CrimeThink Roundup. Brief history, immediate context, and some advice for people preparing to protest. In this case, to protest the 2018 G20, including links to their stories on previous G20 organizing efforts. Crime Think, owning protests since 2015, somewhere in there.
Argentina, without fear and with perseverance, lets extend the offensive. From Anonymous, a translation of a piece from Publicacion Refractario.wordpress.com. This is another call-out, fairly brief, against the repression of people in the name of protecting them. Quote, without fear and with more anger than ever, freedom for the anarchist prisoners, unquote.
Against patriarchy, the police, and any world that needs them. From Feminist Action Hamilton. This is a story about a protest following the cops killing a woman. Quote, because the authority of the police breeds monsters, because all people deserve to be free from state oppression, because the system is working exactly the way it was designated to work. We cannot call for reform or review, but only the abolition of the police and the world it creates. Unquote.
The 2018 G20 in Buenos Aires, logbook November 17 through 19. From CrimeThink, the second installment of their coverage of the 2018 G20 summit. This is a report back of the events so far in November, protesting the G20, art, criticism, immigration, the Mapuche people, feminism. Quote, a predator devours the world. It is able to destroy countries and nations, cultures and peoples, change nature genetically, turn forests into deserts, undermine the seas and drill into mountains to extract the last mineral fragment. This predator wants to leave us nothing, a humanity freed from everything. In defiance of this devastating scene, there are other herds of monstrous creatures that reinvent themselves in the face of this plundering, that create counter-pedagogy, building utopias and errant becomings, unquote.
Audio and video. Video. This is what democracy looks like in Greece, 17 November 2018. From Anonymous on YouTube. 2 minutes and 45 seconds of street footage of riot police apparently attacking protesters for no reason, including a protester seeming to get seriously wounded and then be taken away. Maybe that was a second person? Anyway, shit's fucked up. Police suck. Quote, this video serves as a reminder that this is what democracy looks like, i.e., you don't have to provoke the state or the police to get attacked, wounded, gassed, arrested, intimidated, and persecuted. The state and the police will judge you solely on the basis of your political or ideological beliefs. Some people argue that scenes like this are evident of a fascist state and not a democratic one, in spite of the fact that attacks like these take place all over the world in almost every democratic state that exists on the planet by both left or right-wing governments. The government of Syriza in Greece is a left one. The vast majority of its politicians or members call themselves socialists or communists. And yet you see scenes of ruthless violence by their policemen that are identical to what happens to states ruled by right-wing governments. Unquote.
Anarchy Radio, November 20th, 2018. An hour. This week's guest is a non-anarchist, native anthropologist, and museum worker who defends the good social work that museums can do and talks about decolonization. She makes the fascinating comment that all settlers have some level of privilege unless they're Native American, which certainly pits her against a wide swath of other people using the same language. She was extremely fluent in NGO speak, which is always off-putting for some of us. Of course, she told some very touching stories, capped by hopefulness about communities relearning their ceremonies and languages, etc. So there's that. Unfortunately for some of us, Jay-Z's interview technique is mostly to say wow. So there's also that.
The Hot Wire, number 46, November 21, 2018. 35 minutes, environmental actions, tree sits, fascist actions, anti-fascist defense, the Venn diagram of Proud Boys and anarchists.
No Borders Media Podcast, Anarchist Analysis After the U.S. Midterms. An hour and 40 minutes from It's Going Down. Cindy Milstein, Andrew of IGD, and Jaggi of the Canadian show No Borders co-host this episode of No Borders. Cindy is a smart woman, and while I disagree strongly with her anarchism, her initial offering to me speaks to one of the dangers of anarchists and leftists coming down so hard on fascism as an accurate description of what's going on right now, which is that people use that to excuse varying degrees of abandoning their principles. Of course, anarchists who have been around for a couple electoral cycles will recognize that there are always anarchists who buy into the "this election is the most important one ever." I guess what I can say about this show is that it opens up interesting topics, even if the directions the people go in and the base anarchist assumptions they make are not mine.
November 2018, bad news, angry voices from around the world. Through Final Straw, quote, this is episode number 17, content, radio zones of subversive expression, Athens, Greece, Local News, 105 FM, Lesbos, Greece. Local News, Ljubljana, Slovenia, situation in Palestine. A Radio Berlin, Germany, interview on the struggle in the Hambach Forest. The Final Straw Radio, North Carolina, USA, interview on the nationwide prison strike in the U.S., unquote.
The Final Straw, a jailhouse lawyer, speaks about the prison strike in 2018. An hour and 1 minute. No Sean Swain still. Write him today. Three segments in this episode. First, information about doxing of anti-racists in Asheville. Second, an interview with an anonymous organizer who's with Jailhouse Lawyers Speak about the August 2018 nationwide prison strike. The third segment is updates on what's going on in Hambach Forest, a segment that is also in the November 2018 bad news.
Soulcast. Sima Lee on anarchism, hip-hop, and revolutionary praxis. An hour and 40 minutes. Soul does his white boy fan thing, and Sima is gracious about it, but good lord. Anyway, there's discussions about Sima's background, being a musical parent, how she became an anarchist, making music, and so on. If you can get past the shivers, it's not a bad interview.
Topic of the week. What is our goal again? This week has seen another round of doxing and hostile posturing in anarchist circles. I have to wonder, how do you think this is going to play out when I see the real-world consequence behavior of anarchists who wail about their own need for anonymity while taking other people through a parade of public hostility? When you push a stranger to the edge, they will turn to violence, either interpersonal or metapersonal, i.e. the state. I think that Anon thinks that their hostility will end when they disappear their enemies. But turn the tables and ask the same question. If you were dissected in public, would it make you go away from the anarchist space? Or would it harden your resolve because the worst has happened and you survived it? Within our circles, we know all types. We know who will run as soon as you go boo. We know who will grab a truncheon and probably hurt somebody. We know who will run to the cops. But what is our goal again? Is our goal to win hair-splitting contests with each other? Or is it to prepare to win, to prepare for a war, battle, fight with our true enemy, which is the state and capital, right? Let's say we scare away all the bad people, as tremendously horrible and yet similar to us as they are. Can we then start working on our shared goals? Or will the tactics, thinking used on, and victory over peers lead us away from ever looking at larger impossible goals? Is it fair to say some, many, all anarchists have sacrificed the fight for anarchy to instead have more attainable and petty goals of making shitty people and ourselves feel bad? Ariel, on 10OC.
Hi. There's just a lot going on here. Okay. So if we just start from the actual question, what is our goal? Then I think that that's actually part of the problem. I think that, you know, of course, it goes without saying that anarchists define themselves differently and the things that they want are different and you get to self-identify and you know, your desires and your passions and all that, right? Sure. But I think more than ever, what is our goal is less clear and less defined and less specific. Or perhaps more than ever, it's a moving target based on based on the moment.
Well, let me stop you there.
Yeah.
Let's say this is just an interscene fight between so-called insurrectionary anarchists and so-called nihilist anarchists.
Okay.
Now re-answer the question. What's our goal?
Well, now you've drawn lines, right? You've made sides. So who's our?
Sure.
Right? So,
I mean, those two positions used to be quite friendly to each other.
It's true. They did. Yeah.
Now they're not.
Right? So I don't know what their goal is. I don't know what the insurrectionary's goal is. Right? And it also, it's interesting that I am kind of by some default lining myself up with the nihilists when I'm not sure that that's like left to my own devices, I would describe myself that way.
Sure.
So flatly. But if just looking at tactics and actions, mm-hmm. if I have to pick, I'm not interested in the path that they're taking. So my goal would be to distract the other side from the campaigns that they are waging so that perhaps we can engage in some interesting, you know, political rivalry is fine. Or, you know, we have in the past done interesting work with people from this particular tendency. And I don't see any reason why that can't be the case again. But it certainly can't be now.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that for me, if I were going to divide it along those lines, I would just say that there's been some exhaustion. Like, in other words, the insurrectionary moment, which will imaginarily begin in 2008 in North America.
Okay.
That the people who were around in 2008 are exhausted. And that the fight against fascism that started a couple years ago is no longer sort of enthusing them. And that the internet has become the terrain in which all these fights happen.
Right.
And how in the hell do you do insurrectionary activity on the internet?
I don't know.
Yeah.
How many people are left from 2008?
I mean, whatever. How many began? I think that in that time period, we had hundreds of people who were active. Mm-hmm. And now we probably have dozens.
Sure.
And so in that sense, we're now talking about a very small number of people
right.
fighting with each other.
Right.
Which is why it's so embarrassing, all the big rhetoric that's part of all of this. Is like you know, my dozen people really, really hate your half dozen people.
Well, actually, that's always kind of makes me chuckle a little bit. And it's one of the things I appreciate because for me, it follows in suit with the general air of anarchy. You know, we want really big, really ridiculous mm-hmm. things. And we're going to dream big and talk big. And because if not, then the tanks are just going to roll over us. And that's going to be that anyway. So I kind of expect that that's going to translate into, you know, the petty little wars. And sometimes every once in a while, when I read something that's particularly lofty, part of my response is, well, good for you.
Yeah.
But of course, it is a little ridiculous. But, you know, the politic that we are in is also a little ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So that's just how that goes.
Okay, well, let's talk about this without holding any picture of a person in our mind and talk about the general anarchist attitude of, like, when you're willing to actually cross a line or a threshold. The people you're willing to do it with are people who more or less are close to you rather than the state. In other words, mm-hmm. like, as embarrassing as a smashing of a window may be, mm-hmm. you know, at least a janitor who gets a state paycheck has to clean it up. But most of the situations we're talking about now, especially in terms of the doxing and whatnot, are just about individuals getting fucked over by other individuals.
That's true. So what do you, when you say the line, is that violence? The line that you're willing to cross? I'm not sure I know what you mean.
Well, doxing is a line.
Right.
Like, and I'm not sure I would call it violence, but it's closer to the category of violence. Like, part of the point of this topic of the week is this idea that, like, when you push people to a certain place mm-hmm. where you limit their options in mm-hmm. responding to you, mm-hmm. you know, you're forcing someone to make a hard decision.
Right.
And
absolutely.
And I'm saying that you know, the easiest decision to make is to disappear, to never be around again, and to basically disassociate from people who you used to be friendly with and work with and all the rest. And that's been the common path out.
Yeah.
What I'm saying now is that, okay, well, now there's still some people, some assholes that are sticking around, myself included.
Sure.
And so now these people who were inspired to chase people away, using the same tactics, obviously they're not getting the same result. Mm-hmm. Do they not realize that the results that are left, like if people just don't want to deal, are violence or going to the state? And that's obviously the point that's made at the top of the week.
Yeah. No, they don't. Which I feel fully comfortable with after experiencing all of the rhetoric and threat and hyperbole that comes on the internet, and then in person there being absolutely no correlation to that. Or, watching people go to protests where they know there is going to be violence and an incredibly large number of them essentially not wanting to engage with that violence. No, I think that we're too white. We are far too removed from our punk rock roots. So much of anarchy has been filtered through college and normal society that a good friend of mine who's a Black Panther liked a lot about anarchy. And one of the very first conversations we ever had was about the fact that there's no criminals. He was like, I don't understand how you all think you're going to get anything done, because you have absolutely no connection to anybody who knows how to do anything. And talking about in their Panther days, like, you know, because they were all, so many of them were just Black kids from the hood. Yeah. And even if they were good kids, but they knew how to tap the people who weren't the good kids. Yeah. And it was the only way that they accomplished anything. They didn't fucking know anything about, you know, criminal activity, robbing banks, and, you know, booting cars. But, you know, there are people who could teach them that stuff. And he thought it was fascinating, all of our rhetoric about what we were willing to do and the lines we were willing to hold and the steps we were willing to take. And he's like, how? All of y'all are college kids.
Sure.
You don't know anything.
Well, again, LBC was banned from a book fair because someone else picked a fight with him.
Right. This is what I'm saying. So,
and LBC didn't say sorry afterwards.
So this is like the cleanest, kind of most lily white version of anarchy that I have ever seen. Mm-hmm. And we were kind of, it's not like we were really down and dirty in the muck and, you know, 20 years ago anyway, but now we're so far removed from that. I think that there is an expectation that I have the moral high ground and I am righteous, and so I'm going to win. And me winning means I get to define what you losing looks like. So you're just going to go away. Because people don't behave violently. That's other people. And like, you have to come from a really particularly protected, privileged life to not understand what violence looks like in the world and what people have to tolerate and what people might be willing to do to push back. And that's kind of mostly my experience. Now, I do want to qualify that by saying I absolutely know some insurrectionary anarchists who are, you know, who go to where the Nazis are and are on the tips of their toes right in front of the crowd of people, and they're ready to brawl. So I'm certainly not saying that this is everyone.
Sure.
So yeah, but that's a long answer to the question of, no, I don't think that they even think that this is an option on the table when they push and push and push.
But it's actually important to sort of articulate, like, if our enemies are the state and capital, street level violence isn't nearly enough. Like in other words, even if we
if
we did have that kind of capacity,
sure,
and that kind of people in their mix, like, that's a very naive approach to what it actually is that we would have to be, and which is why the way in which we're now biting at each other's ankles just sort of feels so embarrassing, because it's like,
right,
like, oh my gosh, imagine if we doxed a senator.
Right. I mean, this is why in whenever the Homeland Security does a report that assesses internal domestic threats, anarchists aren't even on the list. And if they are, it's only because DHS wants to make a point to say these people don't matter.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. There is an incredible lack of power in all of our rhetoric. And I think that really a responsible anarchist position right now is to recognize that.
For sure.
And that's not exactly what's happening right now.
No, that is not what's happening right now.
Do you have anything else you want to say about this topic of the week?
The picture's kind of creepy. No, I also think that, I mean, the only other thing I have is that I am worried a little more now than I have been in a long time about, I think that the most unpleasant response is not going to be the people who, you know, I don't know, pick up a brick and go start breaking windows. I think the most unpleasant response is going to be the people who are doxxed, who are exiled, who are pushed in a corner, and who have so little in their lives that when they lose this, their response is going to be to go to the cops. Just to be retaliatory.
Yeah. And the only power that they have. I mean,
right. And that's the problem, because that's the only power that they have. Yeah. And I think that we actually don't reasonably have any understanding of the kind of numbers of people that fit that qualification. And I worry about the way that that's going to come back and bite all of us in the ass.
Bob Black was a visionary.
Welcome to a very special episode of Redacted, where this week we have four hosts spanning four decades of anarchist influences. Joining us today is myself, Suds, with Plast, Hemlock, and Squee. And today we're exploring a topic that was brought on as a comment to our segment regarding the five-year plan, which was our segment about 2 weeks ago. They said, "Hey, Redacted, I just wanted to check in with you and let you know I listened to the ANews podcast on 5 years plans and really liked it. Yearly, monthly, weekly, and daily goals with checklists is much more effective methodology than just saying let's vote on everything, only to be mired in parliamentary procedure a la Robert's Rules. I completely agree that specific projects are better done singularly rather than with a group. And that said, it interests me to hear more about how to juggle conflicting goals and methods for a project among group participants so as not to lose sight of the vision that's mutually agreed upon." So as we kind of break into our first question here, I want to start just by unpacking this question and this comment that we had, because there was an immediate assumption that there were going to be mutually agreed upon visions within having this new methodology of a five-year plan, which is kind of a holdover of the collectivist mindset. So, Plast, I'll direct this first part to you and just say, like, do you think it can ever be assumed that one is participating in a group with a mutually agreed upon vision? Like, can it be assumed without it being stated?
I think it can. I mean, you're in a group, aren't you?
So, I mean, how do you define that? Like, how do you recognize when you're in the group?
When you can get things done without murdering each other, basically, is my definition of when you're in a group. When you're on, like, when you have the same playing field and the same morals, you can have a group. And it depends on your actual overall goals, how strong that group is. I mean, me personally, whenever you have conflict in a group, sometimes the conflict reaches a point where you just gotta let the group just be destroyed.
And so, Squee, let's kind of roll with you on this. Do you think that there's ever an opportunity for someone to assume that they're part of a group, or do those kinds of dynamics need to be spelled out?
I think it depends how formal the group is. If it's a band, like a musical band, then usually you could assume you're part of it if you are holding an instrument and creating a song with other people. If it's something more formal, like a co-op, then if you're getting paid, that's a pretty good sign that you're part of the group. And when it's really informal, yeah, I think usually group norms are what you have to go off of, and learning lingo and knowing how processes work.
And what are your thoughts, Hemlock?
I mean, yeah, I would agree. It depends on, like, the style of group. You have affinity models of organizing that tend to be a lot more freeform, and in many cases, even, like, situational. And then you have things that are more formal, you know, like a co-op, or, you know, say, like a house you plug in, for instance. And I think it's important that we have both. You know, we have some that are informal because it is more suitable for the kinds of actions that are, you know, taking part for those groups. And then there's some that kind of need to have more, I won't say parameters, but more of an understanding of the kind of work involved to take part in groups like that.
And so, like, just to latch on to this idea of the informal, then, because I feel as though, you know, when you are involved in these other kinds of examples where things are made pretty plain, projects that have been going on for a while have a bit of a learning curve. And so if what it is that makes someone aware of the fact that they are part of that, the vision is moving on as a collaboration and not as a conflict, what this can sometimes lead to is, you know, people feeling like outsiders. And as feeling like outsiders and not really knowing what those expectations are that aren't being spoken, what those assumptions are that they haven't quite picked up on yet, it leads me to kind of wonder, like, what creates this concept of in-group? What do you think, Plast?
I think when the group starts to have this sort of culture, definitely like you said earlier with the lingo, I think that's when it becomes sort of an in-group. I don't really like the idea of in-groups, to be honest, depending on what you're getting done. But definitely once it starts to develop a culture is what I would say. And that culture becomes rigid, where people, if they were to question it, you'd be met with like a lot of anger because they're just questioning things that just, like, in their opinion, should be unquestioned, is when I think you have that.
Absolutely. And so, Hemlock, what are your thoughts on that as far as in-groups go?
I mean, my understanding of in-group comes from psychology and how things are kind of ordered in a cognitive way, like schemas, and how folks will usually, you know, classify other individuals in like an in-group or an out-group. And this is especially true when you have people who are involved in organizing on any level, because you have not just like things like common goals or, you know, shared like politics or shared praxis, but you also have to deal with the minefield that is interpersonal politics. And I feel like that affects a lot of in-groups and can also affect like the long-term survivability of those groups.
Sure. And so, Squee, just to kind of build off of what Hemlock was just saying, I mean, not only, you know, what are your thoughts on in-groups, but I guess then on the subject of splintering?
Well, I have a lot of experience to draw on lately being involved in a group that consists of a few thousand people, mostly on Facebook. And there are multiple in-groups within the larger group. So you could have, so there's a group of anarchists who are the moderators of the group. And then there's also groups of more liberal types, and everyone, there is plenty of conflict, but people still manage to go and set goals and accomplish them in their own direction. From my experience, it seems one of the ways that people figure out where they are in a more in an amorphous group like that is they'll propose ideas and they'll see who else will go along with them, and that's how they determine their status or their function or role in the group. Then again, the identity of the group is based around a locality instead of a vision, unless the vision is a vision of the locality. So,
and that's an interesting thing that I don't think I had even really considered very strongly before coming into this, but one of those things that I think probably plays a pretty large role in a lot of these kinds of things. Because I think that, you know, when it comes down to being able to build rapport outside of the projects that we're working on together, being face-to-face and being part of a locality certainly makes those kinds of things a lot easier. So Squee, just kind of, you know, building off of that, how do you think, without having that face-to-face rapport building, that people can cope with conflict and try to overcome stalemates that can happen?
I think a lot of that comes down to sort of the medium is the message factors, where it really depends how everybody communicates and the way that communication can break down or the way that people can disagree and still be part of a broader communication arrangement, like a chat room, and come and join or leave as they want. If you don't have the face-to-face, then you have to operate in some sort of terrain of communication. And that's going to have a lot of consequences for conflict and resolution.
And then Hemlock, what are your thoughts? I know that you have quite a bit of experience with this kind of stuff too in a collective environment. How do you cope with conflict resolution when there's a stalemate, when there are multiple individuals that just refuse to budge?
I mean, you mentioned splintering, and I feel like that's like a thing that happens often is because so often beyond organizing based on just like, you know, affinity and like a common cause, I don't know. It's tricky. Like one of the most important tenets, I think, in any kind of collective is voluntary association. And I think when disagreements get to a point where they're hard to reconcile, especially in like an autonomous space, that's when I think folks tend to part ways.
And so Plas, just to build off of that and kind of up the ante on it a little bit, you know, what are your thoughts on dealing with a stalemate if essentially neither side feels obligated to leave the project or has any desire to leave the project?
I mean, that's a real tough one. You are asking how to solve the long-term anarchist problem of how do you deal with justice? The anarchist answer has always been just leave or kick the person out of the commune, which I think is very unsatisfactory. But so is like having a sort of due process or having rules for things. But if I had to say, if you can't solve the issue informally, I think it would probably be good to have like a backup like process, like a series of steps you go when someone does something wrong. And if they don't adhere to those steps, then they aren't part of the group and then they're out, is what I would go with. Because there's a lot of conflicts you can solve informally. Like, you don't need to bring in the cops to every little dispute you have with your family. But I think it would be nice if groups had a backup process in case things like that happened.
Yeah. I mean, even with just interpersonal communication, there are sometimes moments where I think everyone wishes that they could bring in a third party. That would probably do a better job than the cops. And in places like Portland, I think that there are networks of people that are adept enough to do that kind of a thing. But I haven't lived many other places that did. But that kind of brings me up into this other question, which is like, how can we be so clear about those intentions without succumbing to splitting hairs and essentially building bureaucracy? Because like, and Plas, this one is directed at you again, just sort of like, without getting hyper-specific about this stuff, if what it's coming down to is banishment, and that's the only response that we have, how do you avoid bureaucracy and still find yourself able to feel good about essentially kicking someone out into the abyss if they don't follow the course of the in-group?
I don't think you can. I mean, the way I perceive it is that like anarchist groups or anarchist little clusters and groups, whatever you want to call them, they're basically mini versions of states. And the reason why they work as mini versions of states is because like the center of power is low enough so that, let's say if you wanted to quote unquote revolt against your mini state, you could. Or you could leave if you want to, which you couldn't do if you were under a government. I guess you just have to avoid keeping things static. Like if you have a process or like any hard-coded morals, make sure that you're aware of those morals and make sure that you don't keep them unquestionable. Like I don't think there's anything wrong with the process as long as you recognize that it's a process and that if you keep it forever, it's going to become dangerous and oppressive.
How does it go? A tactic that drags on too long becomes a drag. So
yeah.
I've heard it put it before.
Yeah.
So Squee, you know, same question, but just, you know, I know that you also recognize how rare people with certain skill sets are people who can deliver consistently. And so, you know, what are your thoughts on this idea of trying to evade both bureaucracy and banishment?
Well, I mean, I don't know exactly how we want to describe bureaucracy, but the more basic idea of that to me is just when your rules and protocols become more of a system than the actual people involved in the group can change.
Yeah, I would call it hair splitting.
Okay, without hair splitting?
Yeah.
I mean, at this point with projects I've tried to work on with other people, I wouldn't really want to join a group that didn't have some sort of clear foundation as to what sort of, you know, how the resources are accessed and used, and hasn't already figured all that stuff out. And the reason I bring that up is because I think that when we talk about conflict, a lot of the time what we're talking about is, you know, if you're in any kind of practical project, how much of a resource is going to get used and when it's going to get used and what the priority for its use is. So, and if somebody has just doesn't want to participate in the ideas that are being pitched, and then they're adamant about their own ideas, there should be something in place for how that's handled already. And that is kind of bureaucratic, but I actually agree with Plast. I think that as long as it's open to being changed by the group, it's not really that big of a problem.
And Hemlock, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, I think that we've both dealt with this at the collective house level and also at the direct action level.
I think it's a matter not of morals, but one more of standards. And that means having standards like on an individual level and being able to govern oneself, but also having standards for who we work with and finding people who also have standards, because you can have all of the rules everyone agrees upon and, you know, whatever kind of process or deal with the accountability that you want. It's not going to make a difference if the folks who are involved don't have standards or don't have integrity.
Yeah, that's a solid point.
I'd like to just directly respond to, yeah, to that. So I just think it's important to separate collective housing situations from projects, because a collective housing situation, the weeds are just so thick with what subjectively people are going to be comfortable with or have conflicts about. And it's just so much of a mess to try to live with people that it's going to be a totally different approach to conflict resolution than if you have a project with a clear goal and everyone can look at that project as an object and relate to it in a more objective sense.
And so do you feel like living in a collective housing situation that's sort of more casual, so there aren't these kinds of foundational agreements that can be made, versus the kinds of agreements that could be made if you were working on a project together?
Well, I think one of the first problems with the collective housing situation is that the deck is already so stacked against getting along with people, because there's all sorts of issues with property relations and there's all sorts of like just cultural standards and comfort levels that it becomes very psychological very quickly. Whereas with a project, you're defining, you know, what would be some sort of object, whether that's a magazine or some kind of collective group that does actions and puts out reports, and they're defining an ideology or anything like that. At least it's something outside, away from the mess.
And then Hemlock, before we continue, do you have any direct response to that?
I mean, that's totally accurate. Like, there's a difference between situations where people are kind of like dependent on a situation working out to meet their very basic and essential needs, like housing, versus when something is like a side project that everyone can do for, you know, X amount of hours in a week. And sometimes proximity can breed contempt and can lead to situations where you deal with a lot more interpersonal politics.
And yeah, I mean, I would certainly agree with that. Especially the point about proximity breeding contempt, and which is kind of a funny, opposite end of this idea that face-to-face can often create better results than one that is based merely online or at a distance. And I feel like this kind of like leads into one of the last questions that I have, which is, you know, can these visions or collaborations ever be built on a concept as vague as anarchism, or only on parallel things like five-year plans where you discover that your very specific plan and another person's very specific plan actually end up sharing the same path? So Squee, why don't we start with you?
I just think they're two very different ideas of what somebody is trying to do with their anarchist situation. Because if you're coming from the sort of perspective where I guess the anarchist goal is to build the commune one way or the other, as opposed to maybe the five-year plan of what your syndicalist labor union is going to do, which has a lot of historical background to it.
Yeah, and don't mix up the name of the five-year plan for being some tanky bullshit, by the way, as you
well, right, no. But I mean, you know, like, what I'm trying to say is that in one sense, the anarchist project of building the communists is a very, like, you're creating something instead of responding to a situation you're in with millions of other people that we call capitalism, trying to figure out what the anarchist response is as opposed to the liberal labor union or the conservative response or whatever other kind of political identity there is.
And you
see what I mean? Like, one is more of a reaction to the situation everybody's in, and the other is like a something you're trying to build with other people, almost ahistorically.
But do you think that there are projects that are not the commune that can exist within the five-year plan?
I do. I think those projects tend to be something like a media project. But one of the initial difficulties is that anarchists don't tend to have a ton of money and a ton of property. So projects in that sense are kind of limited to what you could do in that situation.
Absolutely. And so Hemlock is jumping to the original question about collaborations being built on something like anarchism or being built on something more specific like a five-year plan. What are your thoughts?
I mean, I think they need to be specific. We can form affinities based on ideology, but that's not enough to create the kind of arrangements that we're going to see as beneficial. Institutions are mostly self-serving, and they rely on uniting people under really vague, poorly defined banners. And that's invariably used as a means to subjugate and control people. So I feel like when you have arrangements that are based on need and based on affinity, you have a lot more flexibility, and you don't create this big bureaucracy that has to be dealt with anytime you want to achieve something.
And so since we have lost Plast on this sort of tail end of the broadcast, what I will kind of wonder out loud, and then maybe we can kind of answer to this, is essentially if our daily life, if being able to progress on our anarchist projects is reliant upon our bellies being full, upon us having the resources and the serendipity to actually be able to accomplish anything, the people in our lives that are willing to collaborate on such sophisticated projects, if one is starting alone with their five-year plan, where is the best place to start? And so, Squee, I'll land that question on you to start with.
Well, my mind's not made up on that as much as it used to be. I used to think that the place to start was to gain a lot of DIY skills and to just be a very versatile person so that I could kind of do anything that needs to be done in the whenever the chance arises. But now I'm really starting to think that the more essential thing to do in the situation that we're in has to do with building infrastructure and capacity, just because so much of the anarchist space in the United States has deteriorated.
And can you define a little bit about what you mean by infrastructure and capacity in the United States?
Well, so, you know, what one thing I do professionally is I work in IT. So I build servers and maintain software applications and all that kind of stuff. But so that's one part of it. And digital infrastructure is obviously a huge part of the society that we're in. But I also mean, you know, whatever, like, that Bellamy is done, or even opening cafes or other kinds of cooperatives. I think all of that stuff that came out of post-1960s idealism actually turned out to be really useful for more practical, like, resistance efforts, such as protests or anti-globalization stuff or whatever. Traveling around and having a hub to connect with other anarchists at. It's been really difficult to regain the sort of fluid social networks in a physical way that used to be really prevalent because of different places you could just go in whatever city you were at.
And so just before we move on to Hemlock for the same question, you know, what we're talking about is Bellamy's land project that has sort of inspired or been inspired by their piece about living in the backwoods. There was also sort of Occupy, which had created the space where folks could just know to go and be at all times, as well as the Info Shop, which at this point I would say is probably more successful at an international level than it is at the United States level.
Right.
So Hemlock, what are your opinions on this? If what it was that you were focusing on was trying to create entry points for people who might have a plan and wanted to meet other people who are willing to collaborate on that plan, what would you start with?
Yeah, I mean, I won't answer that on an individual basis because obviously that's going to vary based on one's own circumstances and privilege and access to resources and all that. But I very much agree with Squee in that we do need spaces. Where I might differ in some folks is I feel that we need to have more more permanent spaces, and that we need a mix of both legal and illegal spaces. And unlike action camps like any of the Occupy movements, I think we need spaces that we are looking at as more permanent, and looking at that in terms of ones that are viable, as resource independent as possible, accessible, and capable of self-defense.
And with that, we shall leave this until next week. I would encourage others to leave behind thoughtful and helpful comments, because this entire episode was based off of one of them. And until next time.
This podcast is the effort of many people. This week, the podcast was sound edited by Leno Mabel. What's New was written by Jackie and read by Chisel and Ariel. The editorial was written by Rosinante. We thank Aragorn and Ariel for their help with the topic of the week. Contact us at podcast@anarchistnews.org. To learn more, anarchists and anti-political books, pamphlets, and other material are available at littleblackheart.com. And for news by and or about anarchists and up-to-the-minute commentary, go to anarchistnews.org.